But to prove that someone's assertion that, oh, sure, you've warned me 15 times, but the 16th warning, I'm going to follow that one, it just makes the burden of proof virtually impossible. So this language was developed by the Department of Health and Social Services. I am here today to try to introduce it to you, but I think Frank Bartel is in a much better position than I am to speak to the need for this, how it would be applied, etc., and I would defer to the department. That's about all.
What's the difference between mental injury and mental harm?
I'd have to defer to the department.
Okay.
To me, incidentally.
Yeah, I just, that's fine. If they're going to get into it, that's just a question. Secondly,
I think it's a little tighter, though, you know. It suggests something that is more demonstrable than, I don't know, I think it's...
I don't know if it was a word of art. It has a definition or whatever.
Either one, substantial or substantive or significant, I don't know.
Second, Mr. Chairman, the change in the language to parent, guardian, or custodian. Who's the custodian?
A custodian could be somebody who...
Babysitter?
Foster parent, or
you could have a child who is living for a period of time with another relative, not a formal guardian.
It's a person who has custody.
It's defined in case law. Turner versus Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did we get the site on that?
You know, I...
52 feet, second 557. Split decision, Rabinowitz on one side, Conner on the other. I wrote a long read on it.
That's the answer.
Who asked for it? You got it.
Welcome to judiciary.
I don't remember the size.
Representative Gall, I still don't understand why you're amending 4710.010 and not the reporting statute to require the reporting of mental abuse.
Well, may I speak freely?
Yes,
if you want to fight for it with me, I'll do just that, and I'll make quite an issue of the need and the rationale. But what has happened in this legislature, and I'm going to start today putting it on the record, is that decisions affecting the health and safety and welfare of our people are being subordinated to those expenses considered more politically appropriate by certain members. And I think if we're going to put the money where it belongs, that's exactly what we should do. But since I alone cannot get anybody to do that, I have backed away from that issue and will continue to back away from issues that are politically not going anywhere. This is something that I think we can achieve given all of the types of choices that are going on around us. If we want to improve the quality of our choices and put child protection first and put capital construction second, then we can achieve it. But if we don't want to do that, then we're not going to achieve it, and in my view, it's as simple as that.
Then the answer to the question is it's less expensive
That's
to do
right,
it
sir.
Here than in the child abuse statute.
You got it. This is a very small step to help them implement what they are already doing. To put it in the reporting statute would be to increase the sorts of cases to which they must respond. And although my estimate of the cost is less than the department's estimate, I must concede that there would be substantial cost. In the HESC committee, the definition of mental abuse, which would be reported, was also questioned because of the cost issues and the strong feelings that because of the cost, it was going to go nowhere. I have not done the work to improve upon the definition at the request of certain members of the HESC committee. If this committee wants to undertake such a project, then I will go back and do the research to give a good, tight definitional recommendation that would be accepted by those members who voted against the proposal on the basis of the definition rather than on the basis of the cost.
Mr. Chairman, although the proposed committee substitute takes out the change in the child abuse reporting requirement definition, That provision would have expanded the child abuse reporting requirement to child abuse by parents or guardians, roughly speaking, to child abuse by anyone, which is a substantial, not only philosophical shift, but in terms of workloads, a really major shift in the definition of child abuse. You have to, right now you got to report, you have under penalty of some sort of crime, report child abuse if it is abused by a person who's responsible for the welfare of that child. Under the proposal that's before us, not the Miller proposal, but the bill that's before us, that would be expanded to cover any child abuse. Were you on this committee, would you vote to amend the definition to add mental harm caused by people who are responsible for the welfare of children, thereby drastically expanding the child abuse reporting requirement, or would you vote for what's before us? Do you understand the question? They're both expansions of the child abuse reporting requirement, which would improve the quality of services to children in this state the most.
I regret that I can't give you a simple yes or no or either or, because I think the issues that were raised in the Hess Committee regarding the definition of mental abuse or mental injury and making sure that we're dealing with something substantial and not just, you know, the teacher makes me feel bad. I mean, maybe the kid's a failure at his arithmetic, you know, and comes home crying every day about it. There would have to be a very sophisticated definition.
We're assuming that we're not going to open it up completely, but what I'm saying is, which does more for the children in our state? Expanding the requirement to require that any abuse, regardless of who it's committed by, any physical abuse, regardless of who it's committed by, has to be reported, or any abuse by a person who's responsible for the child, be it physical or mental, has to be reused. Which is a better public policy? Assume you narrow it so you don't have those technical questions. And I'm putting you on the spot.
I appreciate the honor.
It's a rhetorical question in the sense that this committee is going to have to make that decision.
I'm flattered that you would ask my opinion. May I ask you just to help me make that answer as attorneys? What is the legal responsibility of a person who witnesses a murder? How does this fit within the current status of other reporting of other crimes?
What's interesting about your presentation is at the beginning of it you propose to require everyone to report all of these crimes.
Okay, at the beginning of
it. That's a significant.
I feel.
That's what the proposal before this committee would do.
I see.
Say anybody, that's basically anybody because of the loose definition of those who have to report, anybody basically has to report a crime against a child in this state. Pretty important philosophical step if you're going to impose a crime.
Got the attention.
Failing to.
Civil liberties.
It's a real pleasure to have my feelings made. You require me to tighten up my thoughts on this, and I was very involved with the child abuse issues last year, and I've moved away from them a little this year. I'm not sure that I'm prepared to respond to that. I think that it is certainly, as adults, appropriate that the state should expect us to come forward and take note of injuries to legal infants, regardless of what our relationship to those people may be. Just as an aside, for the same reason I'm very astonished to find that there's intent language in last year's budget that suggests that the ombudsman should report or should act on cases brought to him by free people before he acts on cases brought to him by prisoners. An interesting thing to be reviewed. But the point of my bringing it up is that people who don't have the opportunity to take action independently, that puts a greater burden on the state and the citizens to take action to assist them. I guess I can't answer. I'd say that yes, I think that all abuse should be reported. No, I don't think it should be a criminal offense for you to not report if you are not in a custodial or other kind of direct relationship with that child. I accept the current law. I made a comment of something that should be considered. Without a definition before me to work with, I hesitate to say on the record to the committee that all citizens should report undefined mental injury. I think it's a good idea, but I'd say that there is a case maybe where the benefits are not as demonstrable as in certain others, and if I had to make trade-offs in order to get real solid enforcement of what we put in the statutes, I would probably let that go by the wayside at this time. Given the best of all possible worlds and enough money to do the job and responsible reporters and all that, you know, then I'd say, of course, I think it's a good thing to do.
You say, I'm working through this myself, but let me tell you that this all may be moot, of course, because the Miller proposed substitute eliminates any amendment to the child abuse statute, which leaves us where we are now. But if we were to expand the definition of abuse for purposes of reporting, I am inclined to agree that mental abuse by parents or custodians is more important to cover than taking that substantial philosophical step of expanding it to all crimes against children by anyone.
Oh, I guess I didn't follow the thrust of that. So you're not just saying that everybody has to report mental abuse by those people who might have custody of the child, but that everyone has to report mental abuse by anyone.
Well, that's two steps of expansion, I suppose.
See, I guess when you're talking about a child, here's my feeling on the subject as far as that goes. When you're talking about someone who has custody of the child, and if you look at the rape laws and the sexual abuse statutes already, you find that there's a separate crime for people who practice these acts against people who are in their custody. And it's considered a much more grievous crime if you have control over someone to abuse that person versus someone who can just walk away from the situation. For that reason, I would focus on that group. I would focus on the custodian. And if I were going to require reporting of everyone and make it a criminal offense not to, it would be reporting of people who are abusing other citizens who are in those people's custody. That, to me, is a very dangerous and horrible circumstance. Whereas you meet some kid in the street and you harass that kid, that is a very different crime in a lot of ways, in my opinion. I'm not really prepared.
I guess what I'm thinking is that I'm sort of speaking off the top of my head because I'm thinking this through as I do it, but it seems to me that if we can get back to a narrow group of professional people that are supposed to report rather than a real broad list of people for whom it's a crime not to report, if you can get that back to a narrow list again, maybe expand it a little bit, but really keep it to a professional group of people that deal professionally with kids.
Well, there I feel on firm ground about it. Then I would say yes. If you're
then amend the definition of what they have to report to include mental abuse as well as physical abuse
without question
by a caretaker. It seems to me you're getting close to at least what I perceive to be some of the problem without taking the significant philosophical step of saying everybody's got to report a crime, and if you don't report a crime, it's a crime itself.
Mr. Chairman,
that's a big step for me.
In my opinion, and I feel very strongly about this, but I backed away from it as a way of trying to get at least something achieved for real here.
Okay, the other piece of this is there's big fiscal notes already on this bill.
Well,
you're talking about how much money this costs.
I'm aware of that, but I made my statement with regard to that, and I don't want to rag it around, but I must say that, and for the record, in the narrow definition that you've just described, inclusion of mental abuse would not only help us get into conformity with the federal law, but would also provide a significant benefit to the children of our state. And I would definitely support that and would go back and work on the definition to try to resolve the concerns of the two members of this committee who sit on HESC, who are concerned with that definition.
Right.
But unless there is a will on the part of the committee to enter into that dialogue, I don't want to waste your time. I've just come forward with what I thought fit within what we're already doing and improves it slightly.
Mr. Chairman, can I inquire of the department, Connie, here?
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I think Mr. Chairman has a question for you.
Then we'll hear Connie.
I have some difficulty with the entire reporting concept. It doesn't take, I mean, as long as we focus on the needs of the child, the children in our society, how they need to be protected. When we start talking about requiring all members of the society to report things that they see, and then we even limit it, only members of certain classes must report things that they see. That person has to do a bit of screening. They have to look at our definition and say, does this clearly fall within it? This thing that I've seen or thought that I've observed myself. And of course, since there's a criminal sanction tagged along with it, if they report it, they can't be cited. If they don't report it, they can be cited. So we're forcing our population to err on the side of reporting everything. It doesn't take much of a shift, just a very slight shift. We can decide that all people who drink alcoholic beverages are probably child abusers, or a portion of them are, 20% of them are. 10% of them, whatever. It's enough of a percentage that it's significant, and therefore we should have that reported too. Take a look at what the philosophy is behind the reporting requirements in some of the communist countries today, and what occurred in Nazi Germany. Honest to God, folks, you're just a slight step away from it, and all we're doing is we're justifying it because we got kids that we think are in trouble. And I want you to just keep that thought in mind. And it isn't too hard to figure out whether or not you want reporting or not if you put that in.
Mr. Chairman? I agree with Representative Taylor's concern, and for that reason I only mentioned the everybody should report concept for you guys to throw back and forth. If I had to make a statement about it, and I think I'd like to, I tend to think that the existing reporting requirement, where those people who are in those special roles with children, where they see the kids every day or where they are dealing with that child in a medical situation, that is where it should be targeted. That the existing law seems good to me, and if I were writing the bill, I would expand it to say those people should also be reporting mental injury. And when you look at the definition of mental injury, you find that you've got to have a demonstrable effect. It's not that the child is being harassed, it's that the child is in fact being injured mentally. And that's why I went before the Hess Committee with the amendment to include mental injury in the reporting requirement as it exists at this time, and that is what I support. If we expand the reporting requirement, then I'd have to rethink my position on where mental injury belongs.
I'd like to ask Ms. Seip, if I could, she's been sitting here and hearing the conversation, and I'm working this through, but what is the impact if we were to eliminate the proposed change to the reporting requirement, which expands it to beyond custodians, but expand that reporting requirement to mental abuse? And I'm speaking of a strict definition of mental abuse, where you may be able to, a strict definition of mental abuse. What's your reaction to that, General?
Okay, one of the reasons that the section that expands reporting to people outside families seems to be confusing every time it comes up is because it was very carefully worked out to make those reports still go to law enforcement people. And so that's the way in which the department dealt with the fiscal impact of that expanded reporting requirement, was that all the reports weren't necessarily going to come through. Also, the reports of strangers abusing children who are not their own does not have a direct fiscal impact on the department because, and there are many who say this is terrible, because the department does not provide services to the abused child who's not abused by a family member. I mean, we sometimes help out and try to provide in communities, but if a child is with their family and is molested by a stranger, the DFYS does not provide that service. So those expanded reporting provisions, although we find them somewhat, we think they're somewhat confusing, we could live without that expansion. The prosecutor would rather have it. Those don't have a very big fiscal impact on us. Taking Washington's 5% mental injury caseload, you've got to remember, DFYS budget is like $55,000. 5% more caseload is another $55 million. Okay, sorry. Taking just a 5% increase in our children's caseload, that's at the first year, and that's Peter's Washington figure, 5% down in Washington State. We worked it out, and I made the division chop it back to 5%. Some states say 10%. Some states say 17% of their caseload becomes just these difficult mental injury cases. Even at 5%, in the first year, we expect another 527 intakes. They're going to be very difficult cases because you're not going to be able to do it by showing a bruise. You're going to have to get the kid through two or three psychological testings, according to what we've talked to lawyers who do it, to get a court to believe that this kid's got enough mental injury that they can be put in the state's custody or required to go through treatment. The treatment they need is not just to be put in a safe, happy foster home. They need ongoing psychological counseling, more expensive than most of our kids presently get. Many of them could probably use it, but most of them don't get it. And we figured out that the fiscal impact for FISC 86, and I had it chopped in half, is $1.5 million. I mean, we brought it down to $1.5 million for the first year. We're not saying that this doesn't necessarily need to be done. We're saying it's expensive, and we expect it, if it's in the reporting statute, if more people become familiar with this reporting, the next year it could be double that, because 10% is what the national average is.
How much money does DFYS have in this fiscal year to this program?
On 88? Well, we didn't have any on 88 itself.
Assuming that the money is not funded in the budget for the new social workers.
I don't really know anymore because it's been moved so much. I mean, it was about $1.8 million on social
workers. About $1.8 million.
Yeah, it was about $1.8 million.
How many bodies is that translating? I don't remember. I used to be
40.
33, and some underfunding of last year.
We'll get 40 for $1 million.
Well, and then there's, in one of the houses, the...
4 or 5 in the legal services office in Ketchikan.
Right. I understand that.
It's about 33, 35, and but you got to keep remembering that those are the ones that deal with our current caseloads that everybody says we're not doing well enough on. Mm-hmm. It's pretty hard to be this far down. It always sounds like we don't want to help on these situations.
What did we do in the state's general fund budget for $300 million a year?
We did the same thing when everybody got paid last year.
I did.
Well, no, to be honest, we're going to go here.
Okay.
I'm going to become committee counsel that afternoon and then Caden has to leave.
Mr. Chairman, can I suggest that I don't yet know how I feel about Representative Gall's amendment because I would like to strengthen it by putting it into the definition, but I've obviously got to think that through in light of what Connie's saying.
Do you want to vote on
amendment? Yeah, we could wait on that. In fact, another question I was going to ask is how far do we want to ask Peter to go and supply in what I perceive to be a great deal of additional information that he's got in his files in this area that he was talking about earlier? If the majority of the committee here is seriously considering this expansion, then we probably ought to let him bring up his files. In any case, it might be a good idea. We touched the idea. It might be good now for us to go back to the bill, decide what we want to do that. I don't know what bearing that will have on the amendment, pro or con, perhaps not at all, but then we could take this up again a little bit later on, since we've had a little chance to chew on it a bit.
Just to see the Alaska statute, or the Washington statute.
I will provide all that to you. Let me just make a brief statement, if I may, and I'll make it very brief. This issue of reporting is what brought me into this, because I wanted to get us in compliance with the federal law as an end in itself. It's proven to be a very difficult thing to achieve, and I don't believe that the committee, unless you are predisposed to saying, the heck with the cost, we're going to do it, I'd rather separate the issues, because what I've tried to do is back away from expanding the state's programs and merely clean up the definition that they use in their existing program, and I would really like to see you adopt that small thing, and then if you decide you want to expand, please do. I'll provide you with any information you need, but it would, I think, benefit the department, and I think Connie and Frank can speak to that in terms of the job they are already doing, I must stress. If they could get this slight language change, for that reason I would like to recommend that you act on the amendment and then make a decision of your own as to whether you want to expand the scope of the program and do it or not do it as you see fit, and I'll provide you any information I can.
Let me ask you this question. You heard Connie say that even accepting the 5% Washington deals, we're still talking about $1.5 million.
And that's if you go with the reporting requirement.
Chairman Miller,
what's the cost if we don't? If we just go with just the amendment only, I guess I missed that point.
Because it wasn't what Representative Clarkson asked, I hadn't addressed that. These figures have not gone through the full department's fiscal note scrutiny, so I'm not as sure of these. I mean, perhaps they could be reduced a little, but I don't think they can be totally. We gave an estimate in a letter to Representative Gall and Representative Grunberg of $367,000 per year because of the need for counseling. And I mean, we might be able to bring down a little, but probably not a lot. I would also just like to put on the record that the federal laws are that ask us to have mental injury as part of reporting are, I call them incentive laws. They will give us money if we do it. But the amount of money, for instance, allocated to Alaska is between $40,000 and $44,000.
So if you reduce it down to even $250,000, it's still going to cost us $200,000.
Yes.
Now, right.
This is the letter she's referring to. I think maybe we want to get.
And Mr. Chairman, for just purposes of background, I'd like to remind the committee that the Juneau Receiving Home has a problem which was not covered in the press. And that problem is that when the kids go in there, they do not receive adequate psychological treatment. And I can assure the committee, as I'm sure the committee could assure me, that a child who has been raped by his or her father or mother and goes into a custodial situation in a group home needs some psychological counseling. if this bill increases the cost to the state because it allows them to justify more counseling, I think that is a cost that is critically needed and should be done anyway. And if this is the excuse for getting that money spent, then more power to it, you know.
Let me ask Connie real quickly. Would what Peter just described happen in the case of the juvenile receiving home? I mean, was that an accurate example in your view?
Sometimes the children have some initial psychological evaluations. And I'm not sure how much counseling we can afford in each case. Not as much as we'd like, I know that. Many of the kids are supposed to get treatment in their placement. Frank, can you address that better?
I'd go away now and leave Frank, who really is the person who can answer these questions.
Yeah, Ms. Taylor's been wanting to get a word in here edgewise, too. Go ahead.
I'm not that concerned about the fiscal note, and most of us weren't that concerned about the fiscal note, whatever the implication may have been that's been given. Most of us were concerned about the definition. We were going to require people to report something that we couldn't even figure out what it was that they had to report. It's a very, very difficult concept to define so that you can communicate to another human being, if you see these sorts of objective symptoms, you must report it or we're going to make a criminal out of you. And I have a real hard time with that. Until that definition is cleaned up where it's something meaningful that can easily be interpreted to the public, I really don't think I want to see it in this bill.
Chairman, you asked for comments of the committee of whether this was conceptual or not. I have the same concern, and if we're going to get into that, and there's one thing conceptually that Representative Clarkson says, that assuming a tight definition of mental abuse, can we go forward with this? Hey, I've been on this committee for 100 days, and I'll tell you, we will not agree on a definition of mental abuse by the end of this session. That is as sure as there's coffee in that cup.
That's why I moved away from it.
And I would if you want to get something done today and this year, I'd just drop the subject right now and move on.
When you say the subject, are you talking about the subject of this?
The subject of defining mental abuse, because I can't even figure out what's in Section 3 of the bill of post-CS you got in front of you now.
Hey, Frank, do you want me
to call? Yeah, Chairman Miller. Mental
please
harm.
By yourself for hey,
oh, Frank. My name is Frank Barthel. I'm the Division of Family and Youth Services. Mental harm, as it now is defined in 4710. When we talk about reporting mental harm, that's in 4717. That's reporting. Now, as it presently stands, there is a definition for mental harm in 4710, A2B, and that's what Mr. Representative Gall has addressed, was to put mental harm there. The problem, the draft you have in front of you was worked out between myself, Ed Hine, and Linda Ciro, who's an AG for the Department of Law, who represents the division on the civil side. And the problem with mental harm as it stands now, you have to show mental harm, that's number one. Secondly, you must prove that the parent is unwilling. Often the parents say, okay, we'll take care of that. And that's where the difficulty lies. When you have physical harm, all you need to show is physical harm. You needn't ask the parent, will you change your behavior in the future? It doesn't matter if the parents say, I'm not going to do it in the future. You can take custody. That does not mean you're going to remove the child from the home, but you have a court order that you can then force the parent to take care of the business they should be taking care of. So it is with mental harm. If you make the changes that Representative Gall suggests, it gives the division the opportunity to take custody, to get a court order, and have the mental or the medical treatment or other treatment that's necessary for that child. You have a court order behind you. As it stands now, the AGs don't take these cases because of the difficulty of proving unwillingness on the parent side. If we can only show that they fail, then we could have the court order. And that's possibly the easiest way to go at mental harm presently.
Yeah, from a practitioner's point of view, the important thing in the Gall Amendment is that on page 2, the change between unwillingness and failure, that's the guts of the amendment. It doesn't have anything to do with it. It's a separate question entirely from the mental aspect of this. And capsulizing it from a private practitioner's point of view, Mr. Chairman, the focus now is a subjective focus, whether they're willing to do it or not. They have to show that this is an intentional thing almost, or a grossly negligent. The proposed amendment will make it an objective standard, just whether they failed to provide it. Intent being irrelevant. This seems like a very subtle statement I'm making, but in fact, it's usually the focus, or often the focus, of these child custody cases with the state as a party. And it's quite a separate question from the mental injury or not. It really is quite a different issue, but it will have a profound effect on the way these cases are dealt with. And the reason is that what I can see, these cases are generally most of the cases that are brought, and I'm trying to think my thoughts through here, are brought under subsection B. And you show that they need treatment to prevent physical harm, and the parents have failed, are unwilling to provide the treatment. Because that's much more likely than subsection C, or sexual abuse or delinquency. I'm sorry. That is not exactly the, in most cases. It's mostly brought under subsection A. And they usually say the child has no parent willing to provide care. And it's a willingness, and it's the same issue. But they're looking here in subsection B, but it's the same issue in subsection A. The focus is willingness rather than a failure to provide care. And I think that if Representative Gall had brought this in a little broader context, we'd be seeing this amendment in subsection A as well as subsection B. Most of these cases are under 2A. Am I not right, Frank?
I'd have to defer to the Pat on that.
And the usual statement in the petition for custody says, child's alleged to be a child in need of aid as a result of the child having no parent, guardian, or custodian, or relative caring or willing to provide care. But there it says caring or willingness. And here you have to show unwilling. It's a little strange draft.
No, I'm going to draft the law.
Yeah.
I think that cleans it up. I have no problem with that.
Yeah, I think I support this aspect of the amendment. I think it's very important, and it will make it easier to protect the kids who really need it.
Well, it does allow the department to get, and remember, these are sometimes custody orders, not actual physical custody, just orders, to get the child the medical, and by this time, with this amendment, the other kinds of treatment they need. They may be being cared for under two. They've got food, they've got a place to live, but they've got a medical problem or a mental injury problem that isn't being treated. They've been notified of it, they've been told about it, and they could pay for it, but they don't. And it could help us get to some more of those cases.
Chairman, what's our definition of medical treatment in our corrections legislation?
There was. And we had a big argument about what medical
treatment was.
It's in there.
I'd have to look at the list.
It doesn't include psychological treatment, though, right?
That's a separate section. Mm-hmm. But there's something in there. Yeah, dyslexia and stuff like that.
Well, we got into whether it had dental or optical in it, right?
We decided it did.
So this other means any other treatment anybody wants that's other than medical. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think it's.
I don't want to spend the whole day on this amendment.
I think it's a good amendment. I move the amendment.
Wait.
Okay.
Okay.
How about in the amendment, deleting or other, and right before mental injury, insert treatment of?
But you could need, I don't have a problem with the second thing you're doing, Doc. I'd like to see or other.
Treatment is too broad.
Well.
You're talking about the right to take a kid away from the parent.
No, because all this is a jurisdictional statute. And this is used, you got to look at it in the context of Section 08.
Use the statute to take kids away from parents.
Yeah.
You use the statute to invoke the jurisdiction of the court, and the court has a wide panoply of things it can do. I once went through a week-long litigation, and all they wanted to do was to have a social worker assigned to the case on a permanent basis because they had a mother who was slightly whacked.
The statute interferes with the parental.
That's not the question. You're talking about the kind of treatment.
Mental injury.
There are,
don't say medical.
You may need psychological, which is medical treatment, or some other kind of treatment. It's
treatment to deal with mental.
Oh, do you see what he's saying? He's saying
you just
treatment
want to, put in different
to cure, alleviate, or prevent substantial physical harm.
So, or treatment medical treatment to deal with physical harm,
or mental treatment
to deal with mental injury.
Okay, you want to put the treatment.
Maybe I don't understand you. Start this.
The child being in need of medical treatment to cure, alleviate, or prevent substantial physical harm, comma, or treatment of mental injury.
Sure, that's fine.
Or would you have to have in need of treatment of mental
injury? I see what
you're
saying.
Right, it does. In need of.
Yeah.
Or in need of.
Yeah.
In need of treatment of mental harm or mental.
I think that just clarifies it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the purpose is to cut off. Yeah.
Did we get a definition, distinction between injury and harm?
Yeah, I don't see what the difference is.
No, I think one of the things we want to put mental injury in, because that's what the federal statute refers to, mental injury. But
I would prefer to leave. I'm moving if we adopt the Clark's Amendment.
Is there objection to the Clark's Amendment?
Well, let me just.
I think
yes, there is
much more restrictive than harm myself.
Let's get to that.
I think it's just kind of poor wording, if nothing else. I like what he's doing, but I think it's poor wording when he says, or in need of treatment of mental injury. I think there ought to be a much cleaner way to say that.
Treatment for mental injury.
Or in need of treatment for. Okay, that's poor, I guess.
I move the clause.
As evidence by failure.
Well, let's just, once you withdraw your motion.
I withdraw my motion.
And then let's play with this one.
I think it's going to be okay, don't you?
Yeah, I don't see it.
I think it's okay.
What about other treatment to cure, alleviate, or prevent substantial physical harm, non-medical treatment?
On page two, you don't care about the additional that wording we had here is that when you're talking about parent, guardian, or custodian has failed. I don't know if we want this initial impact
the legal practice of medicine
to be a child in need of aid before they're even notified. If the parents are notified the child needs some counseling and they're willing to take the child to counseling on a regular basis, they should be given the opportunity to do that.
Peter should hear.
The words should probably be, as parent, guardian, or custodian has failed within a reasonable time or failed upon appropriate notice, or there should be some triggering device here other than just, quote, has failed.
Upon request?
I'd like some modifying language in there to indicate that they had an opportunity to clean up the problem themselves but failed to do so, and therefore the state needs to take the action.
This is a general jurisdictional statute, and if you have some kind of a triggering mechanism like that, you may very well have an emergency situation where the department has got to come in. This is not intended to do anything other than invoke the potential jurisdiction of the court. And no court's going to, all the cases I've been involved, they give every possible chance to the parents.
We're talking just of courts here, Max. This can be exercised on an emergency basis on the part of the social worker herself. You can take emergency custody of the child based upon her review, believing these things to be the case, and she, of course, has to bring the child to a judge. But the old law was parents are unwilling. That meant that somebody had notified them, and nothing had occurred.
No, finish.
But to get to unwilling, somebody's got to will it that you do it, and then you unwill doing it. See? So as a consequence, when we put in failed could very easily be interpreted.
What's a knowingly failed?
any modifying factor like that, I feel would be appropriate.
Emergency custody is 4710.142. This is not the emergency custody standard.
No, but these are some of the standards they rely upon when she goes forward. She has to look back to something to give, have guidance on whether or not she should take.
You're saying knowingly rather than willfully, then you're talking about neglect. You're saying the person knows that it's necessary but has failed to do so, rather than saying that they're doing it on purpose to screw
the kid. Yeah, otherwise, that Robin's right, then it's strict liability.
Okay, is knowingly acceptable?
Well, other than the whole issue is not acceptable.
I'm ready for an amendment.
I don't like the change from harm to injury, because even if it fails, even if it falls within the federal definition,
it's stricter, I'll tell you that.
It's going to change the state law, and unless we have a real good reason for changing it, I withdraw harm.
Okay.
I withdraw injury.
Okay, Mr. Clark, I'm going to offer the Gall Amendment as revised, and it's as follows. B would read, the child being in need of medical treatment to cure, alleviate, or prevent substantial physical harm, or in need of treatment for mental harm, and everything else stays the same over the second page, and it would read, the child's parent, guardian, or custodian has knowingly failed to provide the treatment.
That
language is adopted.
Drop that language into this amendment.
He does.
That's what right. I just have another question.
Adopted the amendment.
Please
no,
to
I was offering that as an amendment. You're not going to have the ability.
I
think I'd have a hard time.
Just for my own clarification, the last sentence on page 1 of Gall's amendment, what is a failure to thrive?
That's already in the law.
I know that. I'm just asking what it is.
It's a
technical term.
They don't gain weight.
A term in childhood development where they're talking about a child developing normally.
They don't gain weight normally. They don't learn to talk during the times. They don't learn to walk during the times. They're depressed.
And honest to God, John, it's very objective to see. I mean, you or I would recognize it when you got an 8-year-old child and the child is sitting there looking and acting like a 5 or 4-year-old child as far as height, growth.
I've got a couple of.
You're thriving like crazy, John.
You guys talk about what a 10-year-old can do or not do. I've got a 10-year-old.
I got a 12-year-old.
So he can set you up and knock you down so fast and make your eyes spin.
The department is apparently very concerned about the word knowingly and how they're going to show that.
Okay. Colin, go ahead.
If I could, thank you, Chairman. I would like to speak to it. It looks innocuous, I know, but I think it could have a lot more effect to put a knowingly in. I mean, it's back almost to willingly.
Well, why not leave it willingly?
I mean, the parent may not know that the kid needs a blood transfusion, but they should know they're sick. I mean, I just want to put on the record that knowingly may cause more concern that we can really quickly respond to and think out here without going back and consulting field staff about the way cases go.
Mr. Chairman, I offer an issue there. This bill's
a very high standard.
This,
that's what I was going
to
say.
As long ways to go, and you got months to work on that issue.
If this is 88 with the fiscal notes on it, I didn't know that it had very many months to go.
It's a long way to tip around.
3-5 days to go.
All right. Well, Mr. Sun was referring to months.
Knowingly is a good.
This is a House bill, right?
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I think you've got months.
Call for the question on the amendment.
We'll work. Just one point, if I may, it's going to go to the Finance Committee. It's going to be dealt with as a fiscal issue. This is the committee to determine the burden of proof. And, you know, showing knowingly is getting them into the same kind of argument problem and, incidentally, increasing the cost of prosecution thereby.
We've got to the bill yet.
I know, but
this bill
is a different
standard. Yeah,
let's go.
Okay. Everybody knows the issue. This is proposed as an amendment to 88. Is there objection to adopting this language as amendment to House Bill 88? Hearing no objection.
Okay,
now we get to the serious part of the work.
I thought this was serious.
Well, I did too, but now these guys think they're in the same place they were before.
Let me say one more thing about
very high standard
about deletions. Okay, that I proposed on that. I do not necessarily agree with all the deletions I'm proposing. In fact, I agree that some of them, I think that some of them could be in there. What I am, Gail, I'm proposing a bunch of these deletions. I'm just trying to get a bill passed that everybody to agree on what, in a less hurried atmosphere and a more deliberative atmosphere during the interim. So please don't take these deletions as being an indication on my part that I'm hardcore against them. As a matter of fact, as I said, some of them I actually support, but I just see them as delaying this bill and causing controversy and perhaps seeing it therefore never passed the House.
Mr. Chairman, may I suggest a plan of action? Let's quickly go through each section that is deleted. And just take a quick up and quick explanation of why you've done it, and then if there's no objection, if the committee substitute on that particular point, go right through.
Yeah, let me slightly disagree. Yeah. Let us go through the proposed sections that you want to keep in, and then go back and explain why they're ones that are out or out. Otherwise, we'll never get through here.
Could you go through the ones you wanted to take out, Mike?
Yeah, I guess we'll give you an extra.
Section one. Here's my markup on it.
Okay, I can go through that on my own. Thank you.
Excuse me, I don't think
well, we just broke the record. 55. Well, not, I hadn't planned on doing it right now. We probably need a break in about an hour, but we just had one.
I don't know. It would just help me if we just then we don't have to go back a second time. We just because I don't think there's going to be much discussion over most of these things that he's taken out. Do you want to keep most of this other stuff in?
No, but that doesn't mean there's any discussion.
The reason for taking out almost every one of them is because it's controversial. Yeah. We're going to take forever.
Mental abuse, that covered.
Not yet.
In one sense, my motive for taking them out is no good reason other than the fact that I think it's just going to hold up the bill. And so I'm not going to justify taking them out because I say I would probably be in favor of leaving most of them in, but it's just not, this bill is not going to pass if we leave them in.
It may not pass anyway.
That's right.
It's got all that fiscal note on it.
Yeah.
That's right.
It doesn't have my fiscal note on it yet.
Well, the work department is going out of business.
Why would you appropriation?
We've got to pass this even if it's just a number.
Is 15 gone entirely? My first proposal was on page 222.
I have one on page 1.
Now
dealing with the... Now,
somebody better.
You might want to pull out your sectional analysis as you see this too.
17.
Okay, I want to hear what these sections are.
Line 26. Somebody needs a good explanation of why we're referring to former statutes that don't exist any longer. Because former AS 1141-430, according to the statute here, is now 1141-420A2. It's sexual penetration. I don't know. I don't have the former 430 to compare it to the current.
I don't think we even need Gail. I think the answer to that is somebody may have committed that crime, and the statute of limitations is running, and then the statute was changed. If you capture them and prosecute them within the statute the limitations period, you're going to prosecute them under the old statute.
That's exactly right.
The statute of limitations can go up to 10 years in certain cases.
Right.
So you got to
That's why you got to keep formers in for purposes of statute.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know, was that your question? You couldn't find the statute itself. You didn't know what it was.
Well, the drafter's note tells you that 430 is now 428.2.
Right.
But I do have a bigger problem with 1151.130A4.
Where are you now?
That's on line 26. Because 1151.130... is all A4 is deleted, but in the footnote it says repeal C AS 1141-434 to 1141-400. 1134 is sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree. 1141-400 doesn't exist. And as far as I can figure out, it never did exist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stone, the response to the question about 1151-130 is the same that Mr. Coxon gave us to the other one.
if we catch somebody who committed a crime during the time when the former statute was in effect, we have to prosecute them under the former law.
The statute that is cited in the footnote or in the discussion that this is referring to, the prior statute doesn't exist. I can't
There's
find...
a typo, excuse me. It's simply a typo. It's supposed to be 460. It's 434 to 460, and that's, I think 460 is...
1151-138-4 is indecent exposure that has been moved to a separate statute. And if I go through Title 11, I can give you the cite on that. And that statute is included under the current law. So all we're doing is including reference to the former law.
Well, I get a point for, I get a Clarkson
point. You get a
point
for picking up a
typo. I get a Clarkson
point.
All right. Let's move this.
Okay.
That's a big issue in this committee.
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, on Section 3, I opposed this section last year when we were passing. Was that last year or 2 years ago? I don't remember what it was.
2 years
statute
ago.
Statute limitations tolling, but still don't think it's a great idea. But
that's not for whom the statute tolls.
Okay. Okay.
Page 2, I think somebody has a proposal.
Anything before page 2, line 24?
For explanation purposes. We're taking line 9 and line 12. Is that just reversing the order, going from may to shall and shall to may?
Excuse me. What is? Yeah.
What, page 1?
No, page 2.
Page 2.
Line 9 and line 12.
Yes, that's the legislative drafter's cleanup. He's been doing that in the sections. Yeah.
Okay. That's the first time I've seen. Usually go shall the month.
419.
Whatever happens to HS 88?
That's
you have a nod after.
That has been.
Yeah. Actually, the statute should never have said shall the month. That was already in some way back in the middle. I give up.
And that's so that we will. Yeah, as well. It should be right on top of
the page. Mr.
Chairman, page 2, line 27, I move that 6 be changed to 7.
Line what, please?
Line 27.
Oh,
I would.
I had originally proposed to delete this section as controversial. Basically, the public defender feels as though they need the original bill. I think said 2. They need more advance time prior to the disposition hearing to review the predisposition report.
I would move it.
2 went to 6. They really feel like they need 10. I propose to delete this completely, but I think a reasonable compromise.
I'll vote to delete it. That was my amendment is to delete the section.
10's the original law.
I'd like to hear from Connie on this, and then Mr. Ember.
But it's not 6. It's 6 working days, and as opposed to 10 days. 6 working days in all cases will be at least 8 days.
6 working days to me is 6 days.
Well,
no, it doesn't.
That's only in the legislature.
Only in the private sector, you only work 6 days a week.
Right. But it's at least 8 days.
I oppose the amendment. My amendment would be to delete the section.
But if you said 7, it's absolutely
fine. I'd like to see
how mine goes.
No. Are you saying 7 working days?
Yes, the amendment would be 7 working days.
So you're going to change it to 9. The current law is 10 days, and you're changing
it
first. Mr. Chairman. Why are we trying to do this when every place else in the rules and the rest of it does not talk about working days?
Yeah.
It talks about days.
I'll withdraw my amendment for a moment.
I would move, Mr. Chairman, delete the section.
And then the court has ways of counting days.
Then it gets back
to count a working day.
Then it comes back to 10 days.
That's right. There's no way to count working days.
It's in Civil Rule 6.
What if you end up with a bunch of holidays? That's in between.
Working days are 5 days a week.
You got five holidays.
Computation of time.
Well, some days you'll have more than 5.
That's right. There's a statute in 01.
And the court has to promulgate a rule on what's a working day. I call for the question.
Mr. Clarkson removed his motion.
I move to delete the section.
Okay. Here. Mr. Sun moves to remove the section. Which would leave it at 10. I'd just like to hear from the department.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we certainly can live if it is deleted. It has caused, at the same time that the public defender has been concerned that they have enough time to work on these disposition hearings, on the delinquent kids, we have a 30-day time period between the day they're adjudicated delinquent to the disposition hearing. And
there's a lot of work that has to go into one of these reports. So we are often finding that, that by the time it gets from the court and gets back, there's not enough time to get that report done sometimes by the 20th day or the 19th day, so that the other parties have the 10 days. And although everybody needs time, what often happens is then the disposition hearing gets put off till later, and the kid spends more time on the detention unit and doesn't get into treatment. And it really is kind of a balancing of resources. We think a full work week is usually pretty adequate. Usually the kid's attorney and they are being contacted during the report preparation period. Usually people have some idea of what's coming down. Then they want to see the full formal report. And we thought that a full working day, 6 working days, was a pretty good compromise because it got us over always a weekend and meant that people had a fair amount of time. But it gave us just a little bit more, too. And the department's having trouble meeting that. The probation officers are having trouble getting those done. But we can live. I mean, we can do it. It's just trying to make it more practical.
Question.
You got your.
As many of you are in favor to delete the section, raise your hands. Mr. Taylor, Mr. Sun, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Clark, and opposed. Mr. Miller, Mr. Greenberg. The section is deleted.
It's easier.
Mr. Chairman, the next one I have is on page 3, line 17. Before that.
Page 3, line 17. Anybody have anything before that?
No,
Mr. Chairman, going through this, we're not imposing any new committee rule.
Oh, okay, good.
Because I want to go back a little bit and stuff.
I just didn't go through Don's minutes.
Okay. Well, see, what happened is I basically independently of the chairman went through and identified what I thought was controversial, so I'm just trying to dovetail it.
It would help if you could refer to HAS 88 for me, too.
Page 4, line 17, section 10.
That's in HAS version. Yeah. Page 3, okay. Line 17.
That was three, right. 17. In the committee subject.
Section 7, page 3, line 17.
Yeah. That's on line 17. Hmm?
Yeah. One's on 3, one's on 4.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you'll recall there was some testimony on this. If I can speak for a moment, I'm going to propose to delete Section 7. If this were adopted, as I understand, the time frames that would apply is that within 12 hours of taking a child into custody, you would have to notify the parents. Within 24 hours of taking the child into custody, you would have to petition the court. Within 48 hours, and this is not in the bill, but it's in the existing law, within 48 hours after being notified of the petition, the court would have to have a hearing, and then there is no limit on the time period for the court to issue an opinion. If you want to double-check my interpretation of the law, we can take it out,
correct.
But I think that's correct. I am a little concerned about the additional time that would result. If you understand the whole framework of the thing, it would result in a delay. I think there was testimony from Ms. Kleinkopf that she was concerned about that. What we're doing here, Mr. Chairman, assuming we have this large fiscal note which adds social workers, there's every reason to think that it would be easier for them to meet the deadlines that are in the existing statute. Therefore, I'm not sure it's justified to not only get more social workers, but then continue to change the procedure, arguably for the convenience of the social worker and not for the child.
Or the parent.
My understanding is that this is a section where the court really feels the need. You want to respond on this?
Yes, I will. We find that no matter how many new social workers we have, the social worker who's on night duty, or the social worker who's the only social worker in Fort Yukon, and who picks up a child under emergency custody at 7 o'clock on Saturday evening, has to find a shelter for that child, may have to transport the child from a remote village to a larger town where there's a placement. They have to try and find the parents who are often missing. That's why we're picking up the kid. And they have to somehow, in the same 12 hours, file petition papers and get them to a courthouse by 7 a.m. on Sunday morning. We just find that it's often physically impossible to do, and we have been beat up on it about it by legislative audit, which is suggested to be changed to be more reasonable and to be realistic, and we've been beat up on it by the Ombudsman's Office, and I don't think it gives us enough social workers to usually be able to do it. We still have to notify the parents in the 12 hours. We have to get to court as soon as we can. If there's a time crunch, I mean, I don't want to, you know, maybe the judicial branch would have to have a hearing within 24 hours once we notify them. I mean, the court time takes 48 hours after we get the petition filed, but we need one day where a secretary can come in and type the petition, and we need 24 hours to get that petition filed.
This is not a life or death one for me. This was a close call, but...
Well, am I not correct that we're really just talking a fairly small number of people, too, a small percentage of the cases, so that we're not automatically extending an unreasonable amount of time? It just saying that when they need it, they've got a little time.
On the other hand, it's the classic here, if you can't think of a wild case in three tries, you got to quit trying. And in this case, you can always come up with a wild case. But we are talking about depriving or taking a child out of the custody of parents.
If you can find a parent.
Well, I mean, the whole scope of this thing is the state, you know, this big conglomerate machinery coming down and getting in the family life, or lack of it, whatever you want to say, and taking control of kids. And I just come from a, you know, maybe it's my liberal philosophy, but I just think that ought to be as narrow as it can be. And maybe I didn't hear all the testimony in the past, but I would support the amendment.
Remember now, there's if this amendment is adopted, there is 3 full days
right.
that can pass. That can pass between the time the parent is notified that the child is removed and the time there's a hearing. And that's not even counting the time it takes the judge to decide.
Right. Mr.
Chairman,
the judge customarily rules for the bench.
But you don't have to according to the statute.
I was involved and on the bench when this was changed originally and went to that 12-hour program. And everybody in the system was scared to death. They couldn't figure out how in the world could we possibly comply with this thing. And what we ended up doing was we ended up setting up systems that would try to comply as best they could. The reason the 24 hour, or the 48 hours in there is obvious. If one pops on a Friday night, the judiciary doesn't want to have to bring a judge in over the weekend in Anchorage. And that's basically why you got that 48 hours in there. The 24 hours that they're asking for, all the notification that is required is to get something dropped in the hopper, and there's a way to do that. And that's you fill the thing out, and nobody really cares that much about whether it's typed up or handwritten, at least in the outer courts we sure didn't. The magistrates didn't, as long as they had something. And something had to be dropped in the hopper. A petition had to be filed. And you had to make every attempt you could. If they didn't get the parents notified within the 12 hours, you didn't give the kids back to parents because they violated the 12-hour rule. People acted in a much more practical, common-sense fashion than that. The interesting thing is, I think a bureaucracy will adjust and attune itself to whatever the minimum requirement is. If the minimum requirement is 12 hours, they may not make it all the time, but they'll make it a lot more times than they won't. You set the requirement at 24 hours, they won't make 24 hours all the time then either. You could make it 36 hours, same thing would happen. Prior to the time we had the 12-hour rule, we literally would have kids picked up in Anchorage on a Friday afternoon, stuck in McLaughlin, and the parents not be able to know where they were or find them until the next Monday or Tuesday morning. And that's the reason the 12-hour rule came into play in the
first
place.
Well, I think the 12 hours for the parents is crucial.
So I really would be very reluctant to back off on it. I understand you're never going to meet it. I mean, we're asking for an ideal. You're not going to meet it on all cases, at all times, and make everything wonderful. But you are going to make it most of the time. And I'd rather have the department striving for 12 hours as a goal than knowing they got 24 to play around with.
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion on the floor, but let me ask Judge Taylor whether this amendment could be adopted, but we could reduce the 48 hours in the next section to 24.
You could, and you're going to hear Lord Snowden take off like a gutshot cougar on that.
Scott, you want to respond?
All right, let me rephrase the question. Could it be practically implemented by the court system based on your experience?
It could, but it's going to take a lot of work.
Not worth the fight. Okay.
Right now, 48 hours, normally, if something pops on a weekend or a late Friday night, that's the first thing that's going to happen Monday morning anyhow. And as long as you got the kids sorted out into some place over the weekend, people are halfway stable and sobered up by then, you can have a hearing.
Okay.
So
I still have to, I didn't withdraw.
I'd like to have the goal too, though.
Chairman Miller, if the Representative Clausen will consider possibly, if he's got his motion for amendment, instead of being to delete the whole section, to just change the 24 on line 24 to 12 hours, that would also give us something very valuable, because in many instances we are able to put the child back home within just a few hours. But under current law, we must go ahead and file a petition.
That's correct.
And that's really wasteful of time and effort for everybody. Once we find the kids, you know, sometimes just because the kids abandoned wandering around. So if you want to change it to 12 hours, that would be section, the first sentence in C would say 12 hours to notify the parents. The underlying sentence would say 12 hours to notify the court. And but would still let us off the hook where we don't file useless petitions.
I'd agree with that, because the reason I was soft on this is the idea of filing unnecessary petitions.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Has to amend my amendment.
What's the penalty if you don't do it?
Let's just assume
it. Changing to Class B misdemeanor.
That's what your bill is doing in the last section.
What's the penalty to the department if they fail to do these things?
It's $200.
It is brought up in the court cases as something we did or didn't do. The legislative audit people come around and make a big fuss that we are operating inefficiently, because we are pointing out to them we have a statute that says we have to do something that's useless, and they want us to still do it.
I mean,
it is, when you think about it. Why file a petition when the child's perfectly safe back home?
If you don't do these things within these time requirements, what happens?
That's what happens.
It often becomes an issue in the court case.
Is there a criminal penalty?
No.
Is the court case dismissible on that basis?
It has been argued that way in various courtrooms.
Well, we shouldn't be passing laws that we know that the department's not going to.
No, but my question is,
what I'm trying to make the point, Mr. Chairman, is that it doesn't matter.
If you would send a letter to legislative audit to stop auditing the department every 6 months and telling us that we are incompetent, who can't do our job because we can't meet statutory standards that we can't meet, it'd be wonderful. And we spend a lot of time meeting with those auditors and going over stuff and trying to tell them why it's impossible and why the courts are different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and why it doesn't work. And it spends a lot of public money doing that.
Right. So the penalty is in the budget process in the legislature.
Well, and in staff time spent justifying something that's impossible in audits.
The
compromise can the department live with the compromise? Let me tell you what I'm real concerned about. And I have been consistently voting one way this morning, and I'll continue to vote one way. And I think I ought to put it on the record that the staff, a lot of people, spent a lot of time on these three bills. And they weren't legislators, they were our staff, and they were the AG, they were the department, they were various people, and they really carefully crafted this stuff. And we're going through and sort of arbitrarily changing a lot of these things. And I'm not an expert, but I know enough to know what I don't know. And I'm not about to lightly change some of these things that we had a series of bills that a lot of thought went into, and then a lot of thought went into melding this, and a lot of them are compromises. And we can say we don't like this, that, or the other thing, but the fact is, a lot of people have reached compromises, and they may be somewhat arbitrary, but I'm not going to go around and lightly change those things. And I think this may be one of those things. Is that right?
It's really important to us, because to have social workers, they are in a position where they feel that there are laws placed on them that everyone says are impossible, yet it's the law. And what they get beat upon, they are in a controversial situation. The family, even if it doesn't matter what the court rules, the family picks it up. It's the reason to complain to the ombudsman. It's the reason to beat up on the social workers being an incompetent. It is just to enact a law that anyone has to comply with that can't be met is very difficult. I understand Judge Robin's statement about rising to the level of 24 hours. But I'd ask the court to give first. It makes 12 hours difference, 72 hours to a court hearing rather than 60.
For that reason, I'm going to oppose the amendment, and we can rag this bill around, and we can come out with something totally different, and rag it around on the floor some more, but let's get something on the books that has been dealt with extensively. And I feel fairly strongly about that, and that's why I voted the way I did, and I think you ought to know.
Mr. Taylor? My only concern on moving that 12 is that, as I stated earlier, I don't think it's a law that they can meet routinely across the board. They probably will meet it 90% of the time. It's that 10% they're getting beat up on. And during that 10%, The only thing you're giving up is notification to the court so that the court may react if there's been a wrongful taking. And that has happened. We have had social workers who in their opinion at the time, felt it was necessary to grab emergency custody of a child. We had, I can recall one specifically in Petersburg where the social worker took the child out of the custody of the home, transported the child to Ketchikan, Alaska, and did all of this on her own without any notification to the court. And then the parents find out what's happened. They're trying to find their kid, and they find out their kid is 100 and some miles south. And it was not a good situation, but it was the thing that occurred. The court would not have known about that for a longer period under this scenario, and I don't know that that's good. I'm ambivalent. I can go for a longer filing date in court as long as I'm assured that every effort's going to be made to notify parents within 12 hours.
Oh,
and that's in here.
Okay, Mr. Clarkson.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Representative Gruenberg, I sort of vaguely resent the fact that we're doing this arbitrarily. I don't believe that it's being done arbitrarily. And as I tried to indicate last time we were having a hearing on this bill, Section 142 specifically has probably one of the most controversial authorities that the department has. The authority to take somebody out of a home without the consent of the parent and without a judicial order. Very, very serious matter. And I take it seriously when we're delaying the processing of that or the review of that social worker's decision. I take it very seriously. I am not acting arbitrarily. I think that you need to be very cautious when you're having an individual who is not a judicial officer acting in this way and delaying the period of time it'll take to get the matter reviewed by the court. It's a very serious matter. Please don't suggest that I'm being arbitrary.
Yeah,
I'm not trying to reach some middle ground.
What I'm suggesting is that the process becomes arbitrary when we draft laws theoretically without taking into full consideration the realities of what they can do. And it's great if we're going to fund them for more people to do it and fund the court system for more people to come in and enforce this, but you may be running the risk of cases being dismissed. You may be running the risk of additional audits and additional time and ragging the
morale. It's a big morale problem.
This is, you know, the real world is these people are filing these reports as fast as they can.
But again, Mr. Chairman, we're on the other side of it. And I'm as sympathetic to the department as anybody in this legislature, I think. But the fact is, you're talking about taking somebody away from their parents without judicial review. And this section proposes to delay the judicial review. That's a very serious matter.
By 12 hours.
Let's pull up the question.
I guess this is, it's Saturday, and I'll understand that. But, you know, I left a couple minutes ago because
I know what you mean.
I'm going to get a little heated here, but I work about 15 to 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I have for 10 or 15 years. You know, so in fact, I want to come in here and work on Saturday and raise some issues. I'm going to take the right to do it, and I'm not going to, anybody's going to yell and scream at me. Okay? And I won't yell and scream at anybody else. It's about the same issue you had the other night. So don't yell and scream at me.
Question.
Or this bill will never go anywhere.
I didn't mean to yell and scream at you, Representative.
Okay.
Question on the amendment, and if I may clarify, I have sort of changed my amendment, if you don't mind, to say 12 hours. What's on the table, if I can clarify, my amendment is to amend Section 7 on line 24 by changing 24 to 12, rather than to delete it.
That's the only thing.
I would object to the comment. I want to take the whole thing out because as much as your statements about invading the parental rights thing, I'm a pretty staunch advocate of that. This is an emergency section. I kind of have the same feelings Representative Clarkson has, but probably more so.
But right. Okay. Let's deal with this amendment first, and if it fails or passes, you can still move to.
But let me just clarify. If my amendment is adopted, there will be no additional delay between the time the child is taken into a custody and the time the court is advised. There will be no change from existing law with regard to that time. That's why it's such a great compromise. What it does do is allow the department to make a judgment that some cases they're not going to submit to the court, they're just going to release the kid.
We always go after this backwards. You should take my amendment first to delete the section. If that fails, then do the compromise.
What we have before us is a motion to change it from the letters 24 to 12, the numbers 24 to 12.
That's not a problem.
Is there objection to that motion?
Yes.
John's.
No, I'll remove my objection.
Okay. That objection is, I'm very uncomfortable with not doing 24, but that's
okay. I have not got a lot of problems.
Wait, Mr. Chairman, no, I've heard all the arguments, but I like to...
Walking into somebody's home, taking their child away,
that's
a big issue.
And then you got
a big issue with
here.
Me because I've been on that case several times, and right. It just burned me.
Okay. Patience. Now, on the other hand, you got parents coming in and filing complaints to the state of Buzz's office, and then the legislative audit coming in saying they're not doing their job on the court.
Cost of doing business. You're going to take kids away and you're going to give that authority to social workers who are not judicial officers before you get a court order. It's the cost of doing business.
I just want to sum it up. You know, I mean, you guys made all
the
your
amendments.
Speeches
the perfect
and,
compromise.
You know,
it doesn't. It doesn't lengthen the period of time between taking custody and going to court. But it does increase the discretion of the department to decide not to take some cases to court.
It's a
perfect compromise. It helps everybody.
It's a nice theoretical. Yeah. What we have to do is we have, in my opinion, I want to get this thing finished, is to help the department, which can't, in some case, now they are doing the best, and they're gonna, in most of the cases, they're going to be doing this anyway. In some cases, they just physically can't do
it. Hard cases make bad law.
Yeah. But that's what we're
doing.
Okay.
The amendment passed. Well, I asked if there was objection to it,
I objected.
Oh, did you?
I did.
Oh, okay. All right.
Question.
That's why
I didn't hear the question before.
I withdrew my objection.
Okay. I'll restate the question. The question is, should we change the word 24 to 12? And if it, as many as are in favor of that motion, raise their hand. 1, 2, 3, 4. As many as are opposed, raise their hand. That's what I thought.
I want to keep going,
yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move to delete Section 8. The language basically adopts a new definition of sexual abuse for purposes of civil actions only under Title 47. Sexual abuse for purposes of Title 47 would include anything that's a sexual offense, plus the material on the on page 4 down through line 23. And the reason, Mr. Chairman, I'm proposing to delete this is, first of all, because it's controversial. It's a very complicated section. It is very difficult to understand what the implication is, whether this expands the authority of a social worker or reduces it. It's not clear to me, Mr. Chairman. I am not convinced that until we address the question of training, which is not addressed by this bill, but is maybe addressed by some of the additional funding, that it simply increases the burden on the social worker to try to figure out what it is that he or she is supposed to act upon. Secondly, I think it is a mistaken approach in the sense that basically what this language does on the top of page 4, most of page 4, is to say that everything that you do with a child is illegal except what's normal. And I think
where's
that's
your normal?
Line starting on line 8. And I think that's just opening a real can of worms.
Mr. Chairman?
I would like to work on this section. I think it is controversial, and for that reason, I'd like to take it out.
Yeah. I know it's controversial. Maybe I misstated it. I didn't take out every sentence.
But Jill, it seems to me, if you don't have an abuse, I mean, if you don't have a definition, how do you know what abuse is?
But you've got a whole long list of criminal statutes that define very specifically illegal sexual conduct against minors. That's what they're using now, and that's what they ought to continue to use until we can reach some sort of compromise.
I'll give you the case I had, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's a case, I think, it depended on where you were, right? I had a case of a family, I guess it was about, I don't even remember how old the gal was, 11 or 12 year old, you know, who was having some medical problem or thought they had some medical problem. My argument was is that, you know, the mother didn't know what to do. She asked the father to take a look and see what the problem was, and they were in Ketchikan, Alaska. The girl was at school and said something to her classmate, and the classmate said, go talk to social worker. Social worker took the kid out of the home, you know, on sexual abuse or by the father. And I could see, if you're in Ketchikan, sure, maybe you should have went to the hospital with the doctor, but I'll put that same situation, the same factual situation in a logging camp or out in a remote area, and I'll say the parent has the right to see whether there's a medical problem with the child before he charters a $1,000 airplane trip to fly the kid into town. And
you would consider that normal caretaker interaction with the child? Well, the problem is to look and see if the kid really does have a problem.
Well, yes, what you're doing with all language on page 4 is basically setting out the standard for a social worker to pull a kid out of the home.
It's too broad.
That's the bottom line. Before a court has a chance to review it. And it seems to me that there is a readily acknowledged standard now of what the criminal law says is a sexual offense. And that ought to be the standard, at least until we get to explore this.
Mr. Schwinberg, now
let's
talk to respond.
Yeah, I agree with the amendment. I think this is one of the sections that typically causes a problem. So I'm going against what I said a minute ago.
In the very next section.
But I do think, and I'm ready for the question. Let's just get on.
I'd like to at least hear from the Department of Ordinance, and this particular one.
Yeah, I'd like to do this. I know the staff in working on this argued about it, got the place they were screaming at each other, and would put it aside for a couple of days, and come back to it again. I know that when we got into the subcommittee on this, we had some real strong concerns about some of the actual specific wording in this thing. And we argued with one another quite a bit about whether in or by should be in there, whether, you know, other terms should be in there. I really believe that this thing is probably one of the most closely parts of the bill. There's a lot of controversy involved in it. Until we can come up with something that we all feel happy
sort of like heart, you know what it is. Right?
Well, on the other half, I will take the same point, but I think it's staff's duty, and what they did here is to put the issue before the committee and let us make a policy call on it, and not withhold it back there and say, since we can't decide, we're not going to let the committee even look at it. I appreciate having it here.
I think it should be in the committee.
I still would like to hear from the court.
Staff did good work.
The staff tried very hard, and I've talked to not only the social workers who take the kids, but the lawyers who have to make the cases in court. When past the social workers' judgments, lots of other people, including the civil AGs, think this is sexual abuse and that the kid needs some kind of protection. And right now, there isn't a definition. You would at least have to actually leave Section A to give us the definition of what conduct, that it's at least conduct against a child that constitutes a sexual offense under AS 11. That is not in the present Title 47. It refers to sexual abuse several places. It gives no definition.
Okay, Mr. Charlie,
first. Well, I know. I wanted to go on. I wanted to say we need that.
But the first A.
So you, at a bare minimum, you need Section A.
Includes, but is not limited to.
Well, that's true. You're right.
You've got the criminal statutes.
Gail's right. I'm sorry. I retract that suggestion. Oh. If you strike this pair, strike it all together, because some judges are more liberal than the criminal statute.
So you don't want to limit it.
Don't want to limit it to the
criminal
statute.
Includes, but is not limited to.
Well, maybe we'll continue to live without. It's very difficult for us. Let me just say, I would like, if the committee's going to leave it, if they have time, I spliced together, Hayden and I said I'd splice together from the old section analysis, just changing the numbers, this section analysis. But the bottom of page 2 and page 3 is written by Don Edwards, who's the chief attorney for the civil section, who does kids' cases up in Anchorage, about how important he thinks it is that we have an extensive definition of sexual abuse. And he is very persuasive. I don't want to sit and read it to the committee, but I think he is very persuasive. He is talking about the fact that we are putting out there in the schools a lot of programs to tell kids to say no to touching that makes them feel used and demeaned. That tells them that these things are harmful, that tells them that they can ask and that adults will help them and that will make those things stop. And that what the attorneys who bring these civil CINA cases say is that those are very difficult to prove because we don't have definitions like this. And in fact, that's why the committee substitute has back in and here on four pages, lines 11, 12, and 13, the fact that the reasonable perception of the child that the touching is sexual in nature can be relevant, can be considered by the judge on whether it's sexual abuse. The domestic violence people, I think, can testify about the grooming that goes on to convince a child that the abusive activity that's going on with them is not sexual, it's something else. It's a play, it's a game, it's a secret, it's a mystery. But when that child does feel there's a problem, they ought to be able to say that, and someone in the society ought to back them up. It doesn't always mean taking them out of home. It may mean treatment. Mm-hmm. If we want to encourage early treatment with the families before the kid has to wait for her dad to have intercourse with her, if we want to stop at the level where there's fondling going on and the girl wants to report it and we can get that family help, we need a more extensive definition for the civil Title 47 protective statute. That's what the department's saying, and I know it's a hard one, and if you have to put it over to interim, I'll understand, but I'm saying that I think it takes a lot of thought and that we should remember it's for the purposes of 47, which are not just jerking kids in emergency, they're also the basis of being able to get orders on those families to get the kids into counseling, to get the father into counseling before he becomes the worst perpetrator, before we have to have him dealt with in the criminal system. It's giving us the preventive chance that we need in these cases, so it isn't all what some of the public reacts to, that all we do is throw daddies in jail.
Well, I want to make another point. We keep focusing on the family, and that's terribly, I don't think there's anybody in this setting that's more concerned about family integrity than I am. But the real concern has got to be with the kid. I mean, and then from that, you benefit the family best when you protect the kid in the first place. The thing that I think persuades me, and maybe I'm just being persuaded by an emotional story, but read that, the what instance here, the what if. It says, an intoxicated father strokes the upper inner thighs of his 10-year-old daughter repeatedly while making highly sexualized comments. The child feels that she feels the contact was sexual, that she feels used sexually, demeaned, expresses all the same fears, emotions of a sexually abused child. The child also reports extreme fear that the next step will be that her father will attempt intercourse with her. The child's father denies any sexual intent. Under these facts, and this is the way it's expressed here, if this next sentence is wrong, then my argument is wrong. It says, under these facts, the state cannot prosecute the father.
And
it seems to me we've got to have a way that the state can prosecute and talk.